Hello and welcome to another episode of Angel Insights, the show that goes deep into the world of angel investing. I'm Tom Britton, co-founder of Syndicate Room. And if you want more on our flagship Axis EIS fund, head on over to www.syndicateroom.com or follow me at Tom Britton or Syndicate Room at Syndicate Room on Twitter. On today's episode, I'm delighted to welcome Andy Ayam, MBE, to the show. Andy, I usually tell a story of the angel and give a little bit of their background, but you've kind of jumped around a little bit. And so I'd love to hear just your story. That where did you begin? What were you looking at? How did you evolve? And then get into angel investing, if you don't mind sharing with us.
Absolutely. So about 12 years ago, I started a business with my brother and a few friends called Mixtape Madness. And we were really passionate about UK hip hop and grime music. And at the time, there was no Apple or Spotify. So we're trying to create a central location online that you could download and stream this music. Looking back, it was partly illegal, but we were trying to do the right thing by scratching our own itch and solving our own pain point. So when going along that journey of building a business, we were not really aware of what angel or VC investment was. We were only aware of bank loans and grants. So we basically bootstrapped and built that business, and my brother still runs that business today, funny enough. And along that journey, I learned how to build a business. But I stepped away from that business around 5 years into that journey because I wanted to have a bigger impact. I wanted to really influence things in a different way outside of just the music. And I really loved entrepreneurship. That trip to San Francisco in 2015 really opened up my eyes to venture capital and angel investing. And from there, I just started speaking to people and really engaging with people in the ecosystem to learn what is this thing and how does it work? And the first barrier I came across actually was this definition of an accredited investor. Or in the UK, we have this sophisticated investor, which basically stipulates that the wealthier you are, the better the investment decisions you make. So therefore, only the wealthy are allowed to participate in this, which isn't a rule that we apply to investing in crypto or investing into stocks and shares or even investing necessarily in property. We usually have rules like affordability checks. Maybe you can invest maybe 5% of your income a year into angel investing because it is quite risky. Or maybe there's a stocks and shares ISA for angel investing to allow you to benefit from tax incentives. And this just doesn't exist in the angel market. So I was very curious about learning more. And I think the pivotal experience was at Backstage when backing these founders and investing $100,000 into these founders, I realized that they found it really difficult to close their rounds and really that tap into a diverse pool of investors. And that's what really got me into learning more about what are these special purpose vehicles? How are people able to invest as little as $5,000 into Uber in the early stages? And that's where I started learning more about the ways that we could democratize access to this asset class. And funny enough, my first angel investment was a huge failure. In 2015, I invested into an African-based startup that basically maintained engineering equipment for like mining companies and construction companies. And I went full-heartedly into this deal, invested more than I could afford with my brother as well, off the back of a friend's recommendation. And at the time, I was too in love with the fact that it was African-based, it was a startup. It was like, I'm from Ghana originally, and I just fell too in love with it. I did not real due diligence on the industry. I didn't speak to other engineers that understood this problem. I didn't really understand the market. I really didn't understand the product or the situation the founder was in. This is even talking to my bias. I bounced a deal off two lawyers that I knew who both told me to stay away from it because I don't understand it. And I ignored them because I loved the deal so much and I was so biased. I even questioned why did I ask them the question in the first place when I didn't need them to confirm my confirmation bias. So I invested more than I could afford. It was around £5,000 at the time. I think it was cumulatively around £7,000 to £10,000 with my brother and a few friends. And within 2 or 3 months, it became very apparent that they had procurement challenges and actually cash flow issues because basically, they were selling services into these large corporations who had long payment terms or were not paying on time. So they suffered from liquidity challenges and couldn't basically serve these clients over a long period of time and had to shut down the business. So it was a very harsh lesson to learn, but that was kind of my first angel investment. I learned a lot of mistakes that a lot of angels have then gone on to tell me along the way. And I said, you know, there has to be a cheaper way to share this knowledge. And that's where we turned it into the school and doing things like these podcasts to really help people gain that awareness of what this asset class is and some of the pitfalls of kind of just falling in love with startups that you're backing without really understanding what you're doing.
You said at the start a funny story. I don't think that's very funny. losing money, not funny.
Yeah, but looking back, I can laugh, man. At the time, I was definitely sweating.
To be honest, a good number of the angels that I speak to make mistakes with the first investment that burns them, but they get a lot of lessons learned. And I hate to call it trial by fire because no one ever wants to lose money, but you definitely learn a lot more from that first failure than your first success. You know, if your first business that you invested in succeeded, you'd probably think you were an angel investing God, and that would get you into trouble.
Whereas... And even that comment really talks to the culture of startups and starting a business. And you hear a lot of people talking about failure as a badge of honor, especially in the US, and learning from failure. What you've just explained is actually that value that we get from learning through failure and having safe to fail experiments, again, using that product language. Whereas if we continue to win, if we continue to succeed, we miss a lot of the lessons along the way. And we actually sometimes pay it into our own ego rather than account for the fact that a lot of luck took place for that to occur.
Yeah, you say it as a badge of honor, but what I've been reading about failure is there's more failure to learn. Everyone thinks, okay, fail fast, learn from it and go on. But when I think it's Harvard Business Review had this study on what have people actually learned from their failures and which startup founders have failed with their first venture and gone on to succeed, what they found was that the startups that failed the first time were no more likely to succeed the next time. It was pure luck the second time as well. Whereas the people who, when they could separate it and they could find out, okay, what have you actually learned from this? And people didn't just go, wrong time, or I learned this little thing. Those that actually spent time in a retrospective, if you will, and took that time to reflect and learn from the mistake, they were the ones that would be successful, not the ones that just went, I failed. Okay, on to the next one real quick. It's just one of those phrases that gets flung around, but what does it actually mean? Oh, fail fast, grow from it. And you're like, well, you're failing, you're forgetting to learn and grow. So,
yeah, so a big part of what I believe in is leveling the playing field in life. My parents immigrated from Ghana to the UK. And in that single act of selflessness, they gave me a platform for opportunity, but just because I was born as a man in London. It's crazy, just that statement. Like, I've got so much more opportunity than my cousins back home in Ghana because I was born in London. We both had potential growing up, but they couldn't realize their potential because they don't have access to the opportunity. So now as I grow in privilege and I grow in status and I grow in influence in the UK, all I think about is how can I use this to help others, to open doors, to allow others to have a platform to equalize the playing field. Because today, when I look at the cap tables on these startups and I look at the wealth that's getting generated by these investors, it's not representative of society. And the two compound second order effects of that is that for first starters, we're not having innovations built for society, that's by society. It's actually a narrow set of contributors. And then secondly, wealth begets wealth. So we're feeding into a system and a culture that is actually very toxic to the masses, but really allow a few to generate power. And especially as men, if I'm being honest, we've done so much to negatively influence and construct society and how it is today, and a woman's experience in society. And part of what we need to do now is, instead of having that woman's conference and that woman's network, we need the women and others to speak to us about what we need to unlearn and how we need to solve the problem that we've created. By disempowering them, telling them that they need to be domesticated, telling them they cannot be investors, telling them that they don't belong because there's no one else like them at the top. And I'm using women, but I can extend this analogy through to people of color, to people with disabilities, diverse populations. And that's why a lot of the work that I'm trying to do now in my lived experience, and I feel is my calling, is to really connect with people authentically and to create this bridge to opportunity, to this level the playing field and normalize society and life so that in all aspects of our lived experiences, we see people like ourselves and we feel like we belong.
I feel you on that. And when you're in this society, you're in it, right? You're getting fed all of these things. Why do men think they have to be strong? It's because our whole lives, we are told and self-reinforced with our friends, we've got to be strong. We're the investors. We're this, we're that. What was the moment that opened your eyes to the like, wait a minute, this isn't right?
There's three pivotal moments that came to mind immediately. The first is the first time I traveled to Ghana and then South Africa, Soweto, and then Brazil and the favelas. And I realized that despite how hard I thought I had it living in Tottenham in London, I'm hugely privileged and I live a completely different life to people that are really struggling in poverty in those environments. So it taught me that it's relative. So if you have the ability to open up someone's mind and expose them to new experiences and to mentors and different people that can help them think differently, it can have a completely profound impact on their outcomes, because where you're born doesn't determine where you end up in life. The second thing was, my mom was a huge Christian growing up. So she always used to tell me, I love you, like, I believe in you, and teach me these Bible-based lessons, which really gave me a sense of gratitude for every day that we even wake up and we're alive. But also that humility to know that we have to have grace when interacting with others and really interact from an authentic place, because there's more than ourselves at work. So it took a little bit of that ego away to say that I'm not fully in control. There's a lot of luck. And with angel investing, it's exactly the same. As much as you think you're marvelous and you are assessing the founder and the market, and it's a lot of luck. There's a lot of things that are outside of your control. You're not in the business day to day making the decisions. Like, even for the founder, there's a lot of luck at play. And being accepting of that is liberating. Oh, it's a lot less pressure on my shoulders now.
I mean, I'm curious, because like, luck is hugely important in this timing, stumbling upon an idea, seeing something that's broken by chance, finding the right angel by luck. How many angels out there do you think recognize the importance of luck versus, I got this right, it's down to me?
There's definitely a community of angels that I definitely speak to a lot and get along with that accept that there's luck. And what I love is when I speak to investors like Marcus Exel, who I spoke to earlier on today, he was like, yeah, my two unicorns I invested in, lucky. I didn't know it was going to turn out like that. One of them had a completely different business model initially, but I love connecting with humans in a very humane way. And I really just connected with those founders. And regardless of how the journey ends, at a minimum, I knew I was going to have fun on this journey and learn a lot along this journey with them. And I think that principle is a beautiful principle to invest with. And I fully understand other angel investors that play the volume game and say, do you know, if I invest in 100 and follow on all my winners, I will eventually have better outcomes than the average. I get that strategy. For me, it's not about the strategy, it's about nurturing long-term relationships and just playing the long game. And it's one of the principles in our family, is like literally a poster on a wall and on jumpers in our household, something my daughter says before she goes to school. Actually, how do we play the long game, and how do we get away from this instant gratification culture of social media or learning actually an opinion based on what someone said, to really think long term about the actions that we take? And my daughter's 5, and I already talked to her about life's like a pension, like it's going to pay you back in rewards, and it's funny how it pays you back along the way and it compounds, but we constantly have to inspect and adapt. And this is what I love about the agile philosophy, actually, when you work within these startups, thinking about how we could constantly reflect and continuously learn and course correct along the journey. It alleviates pressure. It's liberating when you think that you have this opportunity to reflect and course correct, and you continuously have that opportunity in life.
You're quite a busy individual. You're finding this time to reflect. You're finding this time to share those lessons with your family, your wife, your kids. How do you make that time? You know, how do you find that balance? Because for a lot of startups in particular, and I mean, I know you're on the investor side and on the startup side with your angel investing school, how do you make sure that they all fit together and don't burn you out?
A part of me first said, how can I not make that time? Like, as a thinker, as an investor, as a connector of people, it's hugely important for me to lead by example and creating systems, like my calendar is an operating system where I put reoccurring meetings in my calendar, and that could be going for a swim 3 times a week in the morning, reoccurring, uninterrupted time, beautiful time for meditation, self-care. I have to honor that. Making time in the evening to watch Netflix or trash TV with my wife and use that as a platform to have discussions. Like, these are times that I honor because I realize that to be holistic and to be a full expression of myself, I also need to recharge. I also need to put myself first. I can't be totally selfless. I can't totally just be always putting others first. And that system of using my calendar to just put reoccurring things in my diary, like retrospectives with myself every 2 weeks, like planning every 2 weeks to think, well, how am I going to spend my time for the next 2 weeks? It's hugely important. And something that I was sharing with one of our AIS alumni earlier on today was, when we say yes to something, we're taking on a debt. So by saying yes to this podcast, I actually agreed with you in advance that I don't really want to dishonor that or cancel that. I want to try and honor that space. So by doing that, I can't say yes to anything else because this time has been accounted for. When I say no to something, it gives me the optionality on what I can say yes to. And growing up, the reason that was important is because growing up in Tottenham, by saying no to selling drugs, by saying no to that robbery, by saying no to fighting, I said yes to the optionality of what else I could become. And that's compounded into who I've become today.
You incorporate a lot of these product terms into your own being, your own way of life. So you talked about having your own retrospective every couple of weeks. Talk me through what you do in that retrospective, because I'm a product guy by background as well. And you've got your dev team together, you do a sprint a week or 2 weeks, and at the end of the sprint, you look back on what went right, what went wrong, where did we get the estimates correct, what went over, how do we adjust going forward? What's it like when you're doing that for yourself?
So funny enough, there's two things that really feed into that exercise. One is I'm a journaler. So I'm constantly taking track of my journey, things that I'm enjoying, things that aren't going so well, capturing key moments like this podcast today and putting that into my tracker so that I can really analyze like how I've been feeling across the last 2 weeks, because the feeling of life is really the meaning of life. The second thing I do is I try and occasionally do group retrospectives where I have other freelancers who are really value aligned people doing meaningful work for people who care in the world. And we get together and run a retro where we're looking at what worked well, what didn't work so well, and what would we do differently. And as you know, there's a range of different activities and fun ways to organize basically that same type of introspection, you know, self-reflection. So those are the three core insights we're really trying to drive through the range of activities that we do together as a collective with the three or four other like freelancers and people in this space doing meaningful work.
What have been some of your recent learnings from the retrospectives, if you don't mind sharing?
Absolutely. So I recently left a job where I was employed to do a certain role. And in leaving that job, I realized that I was really a limited expression of myself, because I was hired under a mandate to do a certain job within a certain environment and structure and culture, which I could deliver on. Even though they were happy, it was a limited expression of myself. There was more that I wanted to give. I wanted to spend time on this podcast. I wanted to go and speak at my daughter's school. I wanted to go and do this charity work. I wanted to sit on this steering committee meeting. I wanted to do this board role with my founders. I couldn't do that because I had exchanged my time for money in that role. Similar to what I said to you before in terms of saying yes and no. So in leaving that role, I felt so liberated because I could finally be a full expression of myself again. I have the autonomy and the agency on how to use my time. And I had the privilege of actually having an asset that I'd already built up with the Angel Investing School. And the privilege of knowing that I have an in-demand skill set. If I ever needed to go back and do a few days here and there, I could probably do that quite easily. So what a privilege it is that I'm stepping into.
Yeah. You've worked hard to get there, obviously. And you've mentioned the Angel Investing School a little bit. We talked about it earlier, but I'd love for you to tell me about that vision, where it came from. And now that you're able to work on that full time, as much as you can with your angel investing and everything else, what's the plan for it?
In terms of the inception story, I traveled to San Francisco in 2015 as part of a consulting engagement. So I was there for 6 months, building relationships with VC, venture capitalists, and getting to know the people within their portfolio, the founders, the business development leads, the product managers. And in that role, it was like a fast-track MBA on the one hand, and on the other hand, it made me aware of how stark the diversity problem is within our tech industry. Because all of the role models that I looked up to growing up, from Bill Gates to Mark Zuckerberg to Jeff Bezos, were all white middle-class men that had a very different lived experience to I did when they started their companies. And so I started to question, like, how much of this venture capital money was really going to like black founders initially? And I learned like stats such as 0.2% was going to black women, 1p in every pound in the UK was going to women. And that didn't sit right with me. I just didn't understand. I couldn't fathom why that was so. And I started learning a little bit more about pattern matching and the fact that a lot of these investors that came from institutions such as Harvard, Stanford, Cambridge, and Oxford, or companies such as McKinsey or Goldman Sachs, were essentially investing back into their network, back in people that they knew, back in people they could relate to, back in people like themselves. So the initial thing that I was doing to make an impact was to write blog posts and start a newsletter, sharing stories about relatable role models like Nas, who was investing with Queensbridge Venture Capital, or Arlen Hamilton with Backstage Capital. And through serendipity and doing that work, it led me to a role within Backstage Capital as an MD for their accelerator program, which they launched in Philadelphia, LA, Detroit, and in London. And leading on the London program, it became very apparent to me that I just didn't have a network of diverse angels. Everyone that I was turning to was a white middle-class man. And although some of them were well-intended and wanted to invest into startups, like some of these startups actually wanted to create wealth and succeed with people like themselves. So that really kind of like opened up my eyes to like, what can I do using my privilege and my platform and my network to make a difference? And the start of that journey was really the Angel Investing School, to really level the playing field and democratize access to what has been a very elite asset class.
And for anyone who wants to read more about it, what's the website? What does the course consist of? Why should people apply?
Sure. So the angelinvestingschool.com is the website. And we've recently actually launched an on-demand course, which is the same website /OD. And we offer three basic offerings. We have an on-demand course, which anyone can take anywhere in the world, which is really simple. And we use language that's really accessible. So we actually understand what it means to angel invest with as little as £1,000 or dollars. And then we have a public cohort that we run every April and September, where we have around 30 to 35 individuals that come along a journey as a community across 8 weeks with different guest facilitators who are angel investors, VC investors, founders, and professionals that really shared different aspects of angel investing, from how do you find great entrepreneurs, to how do you carry out due diligence, to how do you actually add value post-transaction. And then we have a corporate offering where we really try and sell into D&I groups in places like Google, for example, where we've just recently completed some training for their Black Google Network in America. And they've gone on to launch a syndicate off the back of that. So they've gone on to use their privilege, their network, and their skills to invest back into underrepresented founders again. So I feel like this is an ecosystem problem. We're one aspect of solving that problem, but we're really trying to collaborate with others that are really trying to solve this problem too.
Amazing. For anyone who didn't hear that, it's angelinvestingschool.com/OD for the on-demand course. I'm not going to hold you to this, but could I check it out?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as you saw with my spirit of continuous learning and continuous improvement, I'm very open to feedback as well. So if anything doesn't work for you, if you want to hear more about a particular subject, I'm more than happy to add that kind of stuff into the course.
I'm going to check it out. I'm going to sign up right now, to be honest. I should have signed up before. You've made quite a few investments now. Have you backed any who were previously unsuccessful?
Yeah, I have. I think most of the founders secretly tried their hand at a few things beforehand. The ones that really fascinate me are the ones that can really talk to that lived experience of reflecting on what went wrong last time and how that influences the decisions that they make now going forward. We don't talk enough actually around the role of an angel investor as a trusted advisor and someone that's able to almost like be a coach and hold up a mirror and enable there to be a space for a founder to constantly reflect on what lessons they learn along the journey, like taking a step back and having some self-care routine, taking a step back and celebrating the wins. And that role is so important actually across life, but especially for founders who can get like all consumed by this passion of love. And I think along our life journey, sometimes we have tension when we talk about love, because we have this passion of love in that we're building a business. We also love our families, but by building a business and being all consumed, it can take us away from our families. We love them both, but that's that tension that we have to manage along the journey. It is one of those things that I take seriously around our responsibility as investors in removing that dynamic. There's a hierarchy here and there's a power dynamic, and I'm an investor and you're a founder, and really flattening that out and feeling like I'm an extension of your team and like I'm going to help you along this journey and be a true extension and partner along this journey.
I think you're right with that. You've obviously got great experience with your own startup, with being a product manager, being an accountant, I think, before that.
I studied accounting, yes. It gave me a good understanding of how businesses fit together from a numbers perspective.
So you got quite a lot that you can add to these companies. When you're doing your due diligence on a company, I'm sure you obviously look at the people and can they explain what they've learned along the way from previous journeys. But what else are you looking for?
Yeah, so I think there's four broad buckets that I look at. And a friend of mine, Jason Scott, really like reminded me of this recently. One is the founding team. The second is product. The third is market. And the fourth is the deal. And on the founder and the founding team, I'm really looking to connect on a value aligned basis. Actually, can I work alongside this team? Do I feel almost like compelled, like I'd love to work with this team? I'd love to be a part of this team. You know, that feeling that I have to get that there's an authentic connection is really important for me. It's really biased as well, but it's really important for me individually, because worst case scenario, I want to have fun along this journey and learn by being along this journey with these founders. The second is around product. So as a product manager, as someone that's worked in numerous product roles, I really care about founders that care deeply about their customers and understanding that they're in service to their customers above and beyond, even beyond their investors. So when a founder can tell me stories about their customers, about the problems that they're solving for their customers, about how they alleviate these problems and the solutions that they're providing, that really fills me up with joy, because I get that they're here for something bigger than themselves. They're not here for the game of entrepreneurship or entrepreneurship as a sport. They're here in service of something bigger than themselves. And I remember one founder, Lewis from Tambua Health, when he was pitching to me, said that, you know, I'm doing my life's work here. this is my life's work. I'm dedicating my life to solving these problems. And I could get that by the sense of his understanding of the problem he was solving for the customers he was serving. And the third is around the market. Do I really understand this market? And can I or my network add transformational value to this deal? One of my alumni members, Ji-Hung Shaw from the Angel Investing School, talks about transformative deals. So can I introduce this B2B startup to two customers who, if they sign up, gives them the traction to really get their next round, gives them that proof point to show that they're solving a meaningful problem at scale. Can I make those introductions? Can I fill those knowledge gaps that these founders have myself or through my network? So for example, for one of the startups in my portfolio, I helped them interview product managers. I create an assessment for them. I help them come up with their product principles. And I dedicate time every month to mentoring their product manager now, coaching them, providing an opportunity to reflect with another PM around decisions they're making around the product. And I offer in that time because I really want to add value. I want to be able to help them move from A to B by not just being a passive investor, but really adding value to this investment. And I'm not saying that in jest, because I understand and I'm okay and at peace with the fact that that startup may grow to Series B, to Series C, and actually there's limited value I may be able to add at that stage, and that's okay. But for the stage where I can add value, I want to add value. That market perspective is really important. And finally, I say the deal, like really understanding the terms of the deal, actually what investment I'm making for what equity and what are the terms of the deal here. And in the long run, the irony is that doesn't really matter as much, because if the startup goes on to do well and like produces these outlandish returns, the actual like minutiae of the deals shouldn't really trip you over unless they're really awful and not standard. Those are the four aspects that I really look into when doing a deal. And in the Angel Investor School, we could give a whole template and a whole technical due diligence sheet for those that want to go deeper into reanalyzing a deal.
You mentioned a lot around product market fit. Do the startups you invest in have to have achieved product market fit before you invest?
No, I just really want to understand the market, because great founders often pivot from their market or outgrow that market. You know, Jeff Bezos started with an online bookstore, and look at what Amazon, you know, on paper, he had no right to start AWS. There's no logical link to say one day he would start AWS. If you look at Facebook and what they're doing with their whole portfolio of products with Instagram and WhatsApp, don't think you could guess that in the beginning. So great founders have that ability to really kind of like, almost like develop new dreams and new goals over time. Like, I achieved this dream, I need to dream bigger and achieve that. This is why I said connecting on that values level is really important, and understanding how they make decisions, because that's what's going to compound over time beyond that initial problem that they're solving. And having that product mindset of continuously solving problems for the customers that you're serving helps you to expand from that initial problem to solve meaningful problems that really relate to that same customer. So I pay a lot more attention to that rather than the market in terms of product market fit. And that's why some of the ideas that I've invested in have been at idea stage.
Nice. You've got a fair few angel investments under your belt right now. And you talked a little bit earlier about understanding the market and how important that was with the first investment that you did. What other lessons have you learned along the way?
If you really want to make money, Angel Investing School maybe isn't the smartest thing to do. There's a lot of more lower risk ways of making money, from investing into stocks and shares, from building your own asset and a business yourself, from investing into property. So if I was really keen on making money, that was my primary motivator, I wouldn't be angel investing. The second lesson that I've learned is from Matt Pennycard, who articulates this really well, and he's a general partner at Ada Ventures. Write the check, write it off and go to work. Having that mentality that you're literally writing off that check and going to work is really healthy for just saying that you're an extension of the team and you're here to work with the team on helping them build this business up and solve problems that are really fascinating to you. The third is, when you're attached to a cause and something beyond yourself, you often go the extra mile to help those people out. And that's regardless if I'm angel investing in a startup or doing work for a charity. And I think we all need meaningful moments like that to connect with people, to really stretch ourselves and go beyond what we're doing our day-to-day to help people out. I expressed before how I have personally gone on a journey on being a limited expression of myself to being a full expression of myself and my vocation and how I pour into the world. I think every individual is on that journey at different points. Having the opportunity to work alongside a founder and have that influence over a founder, you really can enable them and create a platform for them to be a full expression of themselves through the vehicle that they're creating with this business.
And there are lots of things to unpack there. And it seems like you're getting a lot of reward out of doing this, being a part of journeys and such. But if you had to put it down to kind of one thing, like, what's kept you so involved? Because you really do a lot, you know, full-time job, angel investing school, family. that's a few full-time jobs. What is it that keeps you so motivated and so active?
Ultimately, at my core, I believe that I'm trying to connect to people in an authentic way and really show them love. And in doing so, I'm showing them almost like an essence of God, because God is love in my heart. That's what I believe. So when I wake up every morning and I see my daughter and I ask myself the question, how can I make her lived experience a little bit more pleasurable, a little less daunting, a little less exhausting than it was for me growing up as a Black man? I feel so motivated to do the work that I'm doing for the society, for the world, for social mobility, to really help along that journey, because I know there's other people like my daughter that are going to have this lived experience that shouldn't be the same as myself or my mom or a lot of the people that are experiencing it today. And that is ultimately what motivates me to keep on giving, to keep on serving, to be in service to something bigger than myself.
Amazing. I didn't say it before, but you actually recently made an MBE. First, congratulations. I mean, it's quite an honor. And you know, for all that you do, I think CBE next, I think that comes next, and maybe maybe then Sir Andy at some point. So what was it like getting this MBE, and how did that come about?
How it came about is still a bit of a mystery to me, because I'm not sure who nominated me till today. So like, I'm humbled and I appreciate it, but I'm not sure how it came about. When I first received the email, I thought it was spam. It's like a government email address. It was really long-winded. I wasn't sure if this was legitimate. I was going to put it to junk folder. But I happened to open up the attachment and I saw Her Majesty's crest, and I started to read the letter. And the more I read it, the more it validated that this was actually a serious email that I was receiving. So in receiving that, was truly humbling, but I didn't fully comprehend or understand what it meant at the time, because I had no one else that I'd met across this walk of life who had received such an honor. So I started to ask people about it and what it meant without telling them that I'd been nominated, because you're under embargo until it's officially announced. And that's where it really profoundly touched me, when I really learned about what an honor it is to have an MBE. And I started to think back on my dad passed away when I was growing up. I know how much it meant to him seeing my brothers and I just graduating from uni, staying out of jail, staying out of trouble, and how much it meant to his family to think, oh, this is why, even though he's passed away, his children are becoming something great. Like, this is why he provided them with this opportunity and with this platform. So there's so many other people culturally that I connected with who felt like Andy's a role model that we can relate to, and he's one of us, and we're so proud that one of us are being honored in this way. So going with my wife to Windsor Castle to actually receive the medal a whole year later was like an out-of-body experience, because I was speaking to women in their 60s and 70s who had a life full of vocation and serving others, like the army cadets and different causes in society. And I had a bit of imposter syndrome, thinking that I'm just starting my journey and I'm being honored in this way. Like, what an honor. But there's so much more fuel in the tank. There's so much more that I want to be able to do and to give. And honestly, it motivated me to do more, to see these older individuals and having conversations with them about what they were doing and what they had done just really inspired me to just keep on going.
Honestly, it's well deserved. You know, just knowing a bit about you, congratulations again.
Thank you.
I want to wind it back a little bit and talk more on venture as a whole and angel investing as a whole. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit on the trends that you're starting to see in VC and tech that have you excited.
Yeah, I talk a lot about democratizing access. So I love a lot of the innovations that have really spurred on by the likes of AngelList, such as roll-up vehicles, special purpose vehicles, and basically democratizing access so that we can invest with as little as £1,000 or less with equity crowdfunding platforms to really democratize access to the asset class. The gap that the school fills actually with the angel investing school is more that education gap of, all right, now that you have access, it's good for you to actually just have some training wheels and learn actually what you can do with that access. And I'm seeing the same in venture capital, because we're seeing a lot more of the rise of solo GPs and micro VCs and smaller outfits raising 2 million to 5 million in angel syndicates to really democratize access to investing into these asset classes. And there's a lot more thesis-driven funds that are focusing on underrepresented founders or female founders, from Pink Salt Ventures to 10x10 Ventures with Andy Davis and our friend Denzel, who were discussing before, with CGV Ventures. And I think being able to democratize the toolkit so that people can invest as easy as possible with Odin, Vaben, AngelList is great. Being able to democratize regulation so that actually we're not talking about sophisticated investors or accredited investors, but rather thinking about other ways of having protections in place, such as you can invest 7% of your annual income a year or invest up to 50K in a tax investment, tax wrapped ISA. Thinking through those kind of things are going to make a huge difference in democratizing access. I think the other thing that we're starting to see as a tailwind of that flywheel is we're starting to celebrate more diverse founders making it to Series A, to Series B, to exit their startups. and my friend Oliver Brent Kent, who started
Marshmallow.
Yeah, and I've known Oliver from when before he started Marshmallow to when he started with his brother. And we used to have quarterly sessions, actually, where we used to just get together and have breakfast. And I introduced him to actually one of his early investors, Impact X. So go along to those beautiful journeys as well. Not that we need data to justify diversity, but it tells good stories in the ecosystem around why we need to widen participation. And for me, at a very basic level, if VCs are in the business of making outlandish returns and outside returns, it makes sense for me that they should be widening participation, because you want to look in overlooked places that you haven't traditionally looked to really get to those deals that others aren't getting into, especially as it becomes more commoditized and competitive as an asset class. So for me, it's fascinating how this intersection is kind of coming to an end now, where it's like, oh, actually, this is making a lot more sense. And of course, it makes sense beyond the fact that everyone should have an equal opportunity to this asset class as a founder, as an investor as well. I think where I'm still seeing a big problem is when I look at the general partner, the GPs, and they look a lot less like society still. And we need to try and get a lot more people in that general partner pool who look a lot more representative to society and who are in charge of making decisions around who gets to allocate capital to what founders.
You said something there about the rise of solo GPs. I'm going to ask, are you thinking about starting a fund, or has it crossed your mind at all?
I shied away from it before, from a philosophical perspective of I didn't feel comfortable thinking through this innovation, almost allocation of capital to 100 startups, and 90% of them are going to fail, and I'm not going to pay attention to them. I'm not going to work with them or coach them and support them on their identity and the influence and impact it could have on them. But instead, I'm going to concentrate on these 5 or 10 which look like they have legs. That whole construct didn't sit well with me at first. So I had to think through how I would operate differently. And almost like a second order unintended consequence of doing the angel investing school, I started to fall in love with the stories of the angels and the real ethos behind why they were doing what they were doing and how much it meant to them to invest into climate change startups or startups in underrepresented markets like Singapore, like Turn Off Turn On Ventures, which is started by one of the alumni in angel investing school. They're doing a bike ride across Europe to Poland, to Romania, to underlooked hubs, and interviewing founders and staying in their homes and investing in them along the way. Very different mindset to how it can really impact society and the climate as a whole. So having that co-investment vehicle to invest alongside a lot of these angels would be an incredible experience, as well as an experience that I think actually will lead to some good returns as well, because there will be opportunities to look at startups that are making to Series A, B, and plus out of that cohort. So there's an opportunity here to do good and make money too. And that's what really excites me.
I'm excited for you. So I want to wind it back on just one more point that you brought up, looking at VC in the landscape and how the GPs and others, LPs probably, don't really reflect society and how that kind of has to shift. I wanted to talk about the founders though, because you've got supply and demand on both sides. So clearly we need to change VCs, and we've had some great guests on the show, Matt Conwell and Denzel, as you mentioned, who are doing some great things on the GP side and the investing side. What has to be done though on the company side as well, because I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of an underrepresented founder. I'm trying to raise capital. I'm looking at these investors going, they're not going to get me. So maybe I don't start the business at all because I just feel like probably not going to get funded. How do we change that side of it to make sure that they do go after it and continue to go after the funding?
I think two things need to happen. On the GP side, we need the investors that are really interested in this asset class and are really interested in investing in underrepresented founders to be more upfront about it. So rather than just private conversation with Andy and with myself around what deals am I seeing, and I'm willing to maybe back a deal if you've backed it, they need to be overt, more American, more commercial, and just pulling out the blog post, speaking on podcasts around, like pulling out the signals in underrepresented communities to say, we are interested in you. We want to see your deal flow. We want to look at every single deal that we're going to get from you. Another thing we need to move away from is these office hours. I don't understand why a Series B investor is doing office hours with an idea stage founder. I think that whole concept makes no sense. Like angel office hours makes a lot of sense because that's that first round of funding. And what we're trying to do here is bootstrap that friends and family round for people that don't have access to that network, because we've grown up in areas like I did in Tottenham where my dad or my friends or uncles and aunties could write an angel check. In fact, a lot of the times these founders are trying to educate their friends and family on what angel investing is so they could bootstrap a £500 or £1,000 investment into their startup. I think we could do a lot more of equity crowdfunding actually to really help with that journey, especially for first-time founders. And I know that it gets a lot of stick, these platforms, but to be able to say to a lot of your friends and family, you can invest in a safe way, £500 to £1,000, and actually the infrastructure is here and really easy to use, can make a huge difference as well. And then what can we do more to use our platforms in a place of privilege to highlight some more of these success stories, but also these founders that are coming up that really want to get in front of investors, but have no clue how. And whether that's on platforms that we create or debut sessions like what Ascension Ventures have done, or Ada Ventures like putting out in their thesis that they're looking at overlooked founders and markets or impact techs or XYZ, we need to do more of it and signal boost. What I'm not seeing enough as well is enough collaboration across the piece. It feels like there's a lot of different individual towers being built, but actually there's a lot more we could do collaboratively together. So this year I'm going to explore more how I can help connect a lot of people in my network who are doing interesting things individually, but could come together to do a lot more for founders.
You talked about signaling, right, and community-wide signals. So I know on Twitter and on LinkedIn, you're getting more women and people of color on cap tables. But what should I do? I want to promote it, but I don't want it to be seen as ungenuine.
You want to be an ally, but it's hard to be a genuine ally when you fear the backlash of tokenism and what others are doing. And the truth is we need to work in collaboration. Even with the Angel Investment School, when I'm doing private courses for corporates, for their Black Angel groups, I'm bringing along allies into that session. So we have Black women leading sessions, we have Black males, but we also have allies who may be white men, maybe white women also in that mix, because this is really about integration and inclusiveness, not exclusiveness. And that's what we risk happening when we create these private networks and these siloed operations. The other thing we can do is, instead of trying to drag people into zone one in London and say, everyone that's looking to do a deal, come to Shoreditch, we'll come to Liverpool Street. We need to go and host this event in Lewisham, host this event in Brixton. Let's go and become comfortable in their environment. Let's become almost like user researchers and really get on the ground to understand the lived experience and context of these founders that are trying to raise. And we don't do that enough as investors, actually. We almost expect people to come to us rather than for us to really go to them. And I think that's a dynamic that needs to change.
No, absolutely. You've got a vision. You know what you want to achieve. Fast forward 10 years. You're looking back, what do you want your legacy to be?
Yeah, really normalizing the startup ecosystem so it's more representative to the society that we live in. You're having people that look like society that are creating the innovations that influence the everyday lives that we live. I'm not reverse engineering the legacy to fabricate a story. I'm just being present in all of these moments. There's a Far Eastern philosophy and Taoism that talks about Wu Wei, and Wu Wei is about effortless action. It's about constantly being in flow state, being in this flow and this stream. And all streams and all paths of the stream lead to the ocean ultimately. So I'm just kind of going with the flow, knowing that eventually it leads to the ocean, whatever that ocean may be.
I love that. Andy, it's been an absolute pleasure. I mean, was there anything you wanted to add that we haven't covered?
The main thing is we want to work with people and work in partnership with others. So anyone interested in getting in contact and in working in partnership, please do get in contact. I'm all over socials, on LinkedIn, on Twitter, on Instagram, and I am responsive. So I'd love to invite co-collaborators alongside us along this journey in any shape or form. And if we can pour in and help out with what you're doing as well, I want to help as much as I can.
People that want to follow you on Twitter or on social, how would they do that?
Yeah, at Andy Ayim on Instagram and on Twitter. And if you type in Andy Ayim on LinkedIn, if you Google Andy Ayim, it will come up, to be honest. Fortunately, you can follow me through all of those avenues, and at _ and Angel Investing School on Twitter, and at Angel Investing School on Instagram as well. A lot of handles there.
And for anybody who's not watched it yet, your TED Talk is one of the best I've watched. So that comes up in the Google results, I think, for the first on YouTube. So do spend some time listening to that.
Thank you. And I also want to say thank you to you, because even listening to a lot of your episodes, you're using your platform to highlight others and give others an opportunity to shine on what they do. And it's really important. And it's a choice that you've made. But in making that choice, you've allowed for all of us to do what we do and to expand our reach. So thank you.
There's some great stories that I'm getting to share by doing this. Not saying it's selfish. I want to get everyone's stories out there, but I learned just as much from the episode as probably most of the listeners. So it's been a pleasure. I'll follow up with you, my friend. It's not goodbye. We'll speak soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode of Angel Insights. And if you'd like to stay in the loop, please do register at www.syndicateroom.com or follow me at Tom Britton or at Syndicate Room on Twitter. And be sure to tune in a few weeks' time for our next episode. It's going to be a good one. Bye.